All right, good enough.
Sounds good.
Good enough, perfect.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is a real professional operation.
There's no such thing as professionalism anymore. We're done. We don't need that anymore.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on, yeah, Sean.
Thanks so much. We're glad
to have you here.
No problem. I'm so excited.
Hell yeah. Hello, you're listening to The Odd Pod, and this is a...
I thought they're listening to Elaine Mania.
Yes, that's what I was about to say, Trevor. We're breaking new ground. We're going beyond the Jack Lemmon and Matt Val canon to do Elaine May. And
but that's not new ground. We've already been doing that.
Yes, but this time it'll be on the main feed.
You're confusing the listeners.
Anyway, okay, let's get the listeners back on track. So you've heard Trevor.
Okay.
You're used to his voice, but there's a new voice here today. It's writer for many things, including Norm Macdonald Live, The Late Late Show of James Corden, Solar Opposites. It is Mr. Sean O'Connor.
Oh, hi, guys. How are you?
Doing good. How are you, Sean?
Oh, man. I'm so good. It's the weekend. Can I date the podcast?
Certainly.
Yeah, that doesn't
matter.
It's
the weekend. Oh my God. Who doesn't love the weekend? It's so fun. The weekend. Yeah.
Love the weekend.
I love the weekend.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God. I love the weekend.
You mean the recording artist.
Yeah. Right? Oh my God.
Yeah.
Is there another weekend?
Yeah. Every single Sunday, I gotta rewatch Uncut Gems.
Yeah. Uncut Gems, all of his albums, which I know the name of off the top of my head.
Oh, yeah.
His Universal Studios horror maze. Like, I'm just a huge fan.
He has a horror maze?
He did this year. He was like one of, I think it was like Halloween and The Weeknd. Which is very funny to me because I don't think he's...
It was a collab. It was a Universal Studios weekend collab.
Yeah, I don't think he's like...
Screw Dracula. Now we have Weeknd.
Yeah. I mean, like...
The scariest movie monster of all.
The Weeknd is, I guess, kind of the new Dracula in a way where he just like operates at night. We know that. Like, has anyone ever seen The Weeknd during the day?
And in Uncut Gems, just like Dracula, he seduced another man's girlfriend, just like Dracula does.
Oh, who?
In Uncut Gems. Remember the movie?
I was like, yeah. I'm like,
he's kind of a movie monster in the tradition of Dracula.
I was so excited for some tea. I thought maybe like he stole Gigi Hadid.
Oh no! Someone. Oh, I'm sure he's done it in real life also many times, but I'm not really privy to his personal life. Valerie, just to backtrack a little bit, I don't think you really finished introducing what. So is this is the Odd Pod colon Elaine Mania?
Yes.
Like,
yeah.
Elaine Mania, subsidiary of the Odd Pod.
Yeah. Yeah, and the Odd Pod brand. Okay. This is one of our many like. Signature shows.
Yeah,
it's like how that Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee book, how there's so many signature segments that are going to be covered.
Oh, I can't wait till we release our official book. Sean, have you ever gotten the call for Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, CCGC, as I call
it? Oh, no, never once. Oh, man, I would love to know what kind of car Seinfeld would do for me. I've thought about it a lot. Because like he tries to fit the comedian with their personality, and I would love to know what he thinks of me. I guess I would probably be like a mid-sized sedan. So boring. No one's gonna watch my episode. I'm not as funny as I don't know who's on that show.
Sebastian Maniscalco.
Yeah, Sebastian Maniscalco or Matthew Broderick. My favorite comedian, Matthew Broderick.
That would be funny if you were on and it was the one episode where instead of some kind of cool vintage car, it was like, this is a 98 Nissan Jetta. Yeah. Just like a regular.
Yeah, like, thanks?
Wait, Jetta is not Nissan, I just realized.
Whatever. No, it's a Volkswagen Jetta, which like, of course.
I'm not a car guy like Jerry. I don't know cars.
Yeah. But you have to love 17-year-old girls, right?
Oh, well, yeah. I was going to say, I'm like Jerry in some ways. Just not the car thing.
Jerry has like so many things. He's a car guy. He's a young girl guy.
He loves Superman.
Superman. He's a Mets guy. Yeah.
That was that's a funny thing that I think does not exist anymore. Just like liking Superman.
Yeah.
It's like just the worst. It's like the most boring superhero in the world to like. Like he doesn't even have.
No, yeah.
Dude, that'd be so stupid if someone liked Superman.
Oh no, are you a soup head?
No, I mean, like most people, I'm more of a Batman guy than a Superman guy, but you know, Superman's fine.
Well, Trevor's really a Riddler guy. He even played the Riddler in the People's Joker.
That's true.
I can't wait to see that. I'm so excited to see it. I'm waiting for some illegal screening. Did you do great? Did you get it nominated for any awards?
Not that I know of. I haven't seen the finished product. I only saw like a work in progress version several months back. Valerie saw it though, and she told me that I got a lot of laughs. Yeah. So I'm just gonna trust her on
that. That's all you could ask for, especially in today's cinema. Yeah. I mean, no one's getting any laughs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. With the freaking PC police all up in everyone's asses, you can't get any laughs.
Don't get me started.
Yeah, please, come on, just let me say the things I want to say. They're all thinking it.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my very non-PC Riddler jokes did not make it into the final cut. So you know, I've been censored by Vera, but you know, you get it. She's part of the. The Hollywood elite, the woke Hollywood elites, you know.
I'm so tired of woke people coming for our riddles. It's like, stop. We had riddles for 100 years and no one complained.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's solve our own mysteries. We don't need these wokesters to tell us the mysteries weren't even there. How do we segue? Trevor, think of a segue.
Okay. I could have just... Think of a segue. I was just gonna start saying it. So we watched the movie Ishtar. We never do segues.
Yeah.
This is Elaine Mania, an Odd Pod podcast, and we watched the movie Ishtar, which I guess you two had both seen before, right? It was my first time watching it. I was new to Elaine May when we started this whole thing. Mm-hmm. I had never seen any of her four movies, and now this is the third one I've seen. I loved it. What a fun movie. Sean, you're a guest. Why don't you tell us a little bit about Ishtar and when you first saw it and whether it changed your life or, you know, whatever.
When I first started comedy, I got really into collecting old comedy albums. Oh. Like, very specifically, like, Nichols and May. Like, I was kind of obsessed with Nichols and May. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they're, like, the only good thing from the 1960s. period. I guess, like, you know, like classic Coca-Cola formula is also pretty good, but like
came before the 60s, the classic Coke. I think Coke was around.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, like, well, yeah, not the classic.
There was a new 60s twist on.
Yeah, I'm talking, but yeah,
back
like
in the 60s, they had that good Coke, you know, it was real, it was the pure stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. But yeah, no, so I got into that, and then like later on, I just started watching, like, I remember my friend Aloy was telling me how much I needed to see A New Leaf, so then I like watched A New Leaf, and that like blew my mind, and then I watched Mikey and Nikki, and that blew my mind, and then I read Raging Bulls and Easy Riders, and like, that whole book is very anti-Ishtar and wanted to, like, turn you against it because it, like, destroyed Hollywood or something. And Elaine May was ungrateful to Warren Beatty and who the fuck cares. So I kind of, but reading that book, reading that book, I was like, I don't know if I'll ever watch Ishtar because Elaine May is perfect in my eyes. Mm-hmm. And then when I finally watched it, I was like, we've been lied to. It's a perfect, it's so funny.
Yeah.
It's so funny. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, do I kind of wish it just was about, like, these singers making up songs the whole time? Sure. The funniest movie ever made if they just stayed with that. But, like, it's just so impressive. It blew my mind. And then I've just been spending, like, the last 5 years trying to tell people to watch Ishtar.
Fuck yeah. Awesome. Yeah, it's
that's interesting to like blame. Well, because I mean, it was Heaven's Gate was the big one that people mm-hmm. say like ruined, like because it was such a fiasco, like ruined the like 70s Hollywood system, right? But is Ishtar blamed for that also?
Yeah, it's like a two pronged Heaven's Gate and Ishtar.
Yeah, because like it was all it was basically, you know, like I mean Ishtar is Elaine May, Dustin Hoffman, Warren Beatty. It is the stars of the late 60s, early 70s, like the 70s, like too big to fail. And they gave them a huge budget and it did fail. And Warren Beatty, to save face, kind of talked shit about Elaine May and kind of ruined her and put her in movie jail.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
And another good thing about it.
Oh, no.
The difference that between Ishtar and Heaven's Gate is Elaine May didn't blow up horses, which Michael Cimino did.
Yes.
So insane. That's why we now have to say no animals.
I do have some questions about the treatment of camels, though. You know, it seems like... I wonder what the camel situation
is. So I actually did read a little bit of the camel situation before this, and I saw that apparently there was an initial camel that one of like the production designers was looking at, and they were like, we gotta get a blue-eyed camel, and they didn't realize how rare that was, so after the first one, they were like, oh, let's look at some others, and they couldn't find any, so... And they wanted to like barter, but when they got back to the original guy, the guy was like, they're like, hey, can I have the camel, the blue eyed camel? And he was like, oh, I'm sorry, I ate it.
What?
Yeah.
They're so rare, and he ate it?
He ate it, yeah.
Damn. That doesn't happen on most movie sets where, like, oh, it's like, oh, that wasn't the right dog, so we had to eat it. Like, like they ate the first four Air Buds until they got to a golden retriever.
hey, in Hollywood, nothing surprises me.
Holly weird? Come on.
Eating dogs, that's just the tip of the iceberg from kind of stories I've heard.
Yeah, I mean Tom Hanks is like drinking the adrenochrome of the young.
Yeah.
Sorry. You know what they say of Tom Hanks? Sorry, separate the art from the artist.
Yeah, now Hanks isn't going to come on this podcast. I'm so sorry.
Oh no! Yeah, no, we really wanted to get him on here so we could do like a really confrontational interview. Like, be like, what's your fucking problem, Tom Hanks? Why do you have to be the guy who plays every real life biopic figure that people like? You don't even look like Mr. Rogers.
No, I think it's just like he got so old and Hollywood did not want to dispose of him. So now that's just what he does. Mm-hmm. He got old overnight. COVID aged him.
Mm-hmm.
It's also like trading in on his like so-called likability. Like everybody says like, oh, everyone loves Tom Hanks. He's the nicest guy in Hollywood. So anytime there's a movie about a guy who's supposed to be really nice, like Walt Disney or Sully Solenberger.
Or Larry Crown.
He's the famously nice guy.
Fucking Larry Crown.
I kind of wish I know we're talking about Ishtar, but like I kind of wish Tom Hanks only directed That Thing You Do, because I think then like I would have really been like, oh, it's a shame he never directed again because I love That Thing You Do. But now he made Larry Crown, I'm like, I think That Thing You Do might have been very lucky, like happy accident.
Yeah,
he had one in him. Yeah, you know, sometimes a guy just has one in him. Yeah. And his was That Thing You Do, and he should have left it at that.
Yeah, it's like whenever people talk about like Charles Laughton only directing Night of the Hunter, and people being like, oh, what if he directed more movies? And it's like, oh, it could have been the Larry Crown of its day.
Yeah.
yeah, exactly. You're better off having one beloved movie that's celebrated and then just not doing it. Then you get to be legendary, you know? You ruin it by making a bunch of more movies and they all stink.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, everyone makes duds except for Elaine May. That was a pretty good segue.
Absolutely.
Yes.
It became less of a good segue when I called it out that we were high segue.
Yeah.
That's always how it goes with segues. When the segue is perfect, you're like, ah, oh, that was a top tier segue. It's like, oh fuck.
Yeah. Well, now it's ruined again. But as a first time watcher of Ishtar, you liked it?
Yeah, I really liked it. I mean, I was a little bit primed to like it because I've already seen like all the, you know, like revisionist takes on Ishtar from like, you know, the kind of people I associate with online. They're like, oh, Ishtar is actually good. And it's actually like really critical of American foreign policy in like an interesting way that was like ahead of its time or whatever, all the stuff people say. I'm kind of like, okay, cool. That sounds like my kind of movie. And then I didn't know how much of a goofy kind of like a proto Farrelly Brothers kind of buddy romp it was going to be.
Yes. I mean, it's so smart. It's almost like it's very insulting to Warren Beatty as a guy, mm-hmm. like to just make him this complete fucking like hazy dud. Like he's so dumb,
yeah,
and he's so like, and he just constantly is like, oh, girls don't like me. And it's like, it's such like a little, you could see Elaine digging him a little bit, which is nice. Because
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
He seems very like half committed to playing this like Southern buffoon. Like he doesn't really, it's like, sometimes he kind of has an accent, but not all the time.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like his heart like wasn't in it a little bit, but I don't know. The effect is very funny.
Mm-hmm. It feels like he was basically given a note to play the character like Jerry Lewis, and he was angry that he had to play the Jerry Lewis type.
Yeah. there is an anger underneath his performance, so you can tell whether it is using this American icon as socialist propaganda, perhaps. It's like he was angry about that. But man, he's just so funny, and they're so funny together. Like Dustin Hoffman and him, like in a just world, probably could have had like a nice little run into their 50s of like being like a buddy doing buddy comedies. Because this,
For sure,
could have been the next Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau.
Well, isn't this supposed to be like a riff on Bing Crosby and Bob Hope movies?
It was, yeah. That was like Elaine May's initial idea, and yeah, you can definitely see that. I do really love with Dustin Hoffman in this movie how much he plays like, he almost plays it like a Mo Howard type, where he's like, he is smarter than Warren Beatty, but he is so dumb compared to everybody else.
Yeah.
He's like the dumb guy leader who picks on his even dumber sidekick.
Yeah.
Like Dumb and Dumber. This movie reminded me a lot of Dumb and Dumber. Mm-hmm. I think the Farrelly Brothers are Elaine May fans since they did the Heartbreak Kid remake.
Oh, true.
And I feel like they definitely must have taken some inspiration from this because it felt very similar to Dumb and Dumber to me in a lot of ways.
I also think a movie I love that does not get that much play is Safe Men from the 90s, the John Hamburg movie with Sam Rockwell and Steve Zahn, but they I feel like they took a lot from
that's
Ishtar
a great duo
because they are struggling singers who accidentally get caught up in a mafia thing with like they someone at Paul Giamatti asked them if they want a slow gin fizz, and that's like the secret password to the mafia, and they're like, yeah, sure. And then all of a sudden he thinks they're like these expert safe men and they get really involved in the mafia, but they also do these terrible songs the whole, so it does feel very Ishtar like but also those songs are good.
Yeah, they're very cute. The songs were actually written by Paul Williams.
I know, so great.
Yeah. They do have that just amazing vibe, yeah.
The early part of...
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, Val.
I was going to say, like, if you admit you can play the accordion, that gets stuck in my head, like, so often. It's been stuck in my head since the first time I watched it, like, 3 years ago. Trevor, what were you going to say?
I was just going to say, in the early part of the movie, where they're just putting on these really bad shows and the audience is, like, staring at them, at some points I'm kind of like... Like, are we really expected to believe they're not enjoying this at all? You know, like they were definitely like pretty bad in their first performance, but in that second one where they did the kind of like high pitched like R&B kind of song, and like they, I mean, they were really tearing up the stage, you know. Like I find it hard to believe that an audience, you know, even though they're not the best singers, like they're putting on a pretty good show. I feel like I would have enjoyed that a little more than they did.
I'm with you on that. I do feel like their like exuberance was so infectious that like mm-hmm. the audience, like just like basic human nature, is like they're having fun. We yeah. must be having fun. Like they weren't deterred, yeah. and like there's so many reaction shots of just people like looking at them in disgust. And I just don't.
Yeah.
Like if somebody is like bombing during like stand up, but they don't realize they're bombing, it is mm-hmm. usually entertaining in yeah. some way.
Yeah, and like, and you're seeing this amateur band who's like, obviously doesn't like, they're not obviously not like super talented, but they're like, they're putting on the performance of their life. They're putting it all on the stage. Mm-hmm. It would be hard not to get swept up in that a little bit. Like, how high are your expectations for this like little bar show?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Like, you're a diplomat in Morocco. You're here. Like, you're watching. Like you've paid to just watch two people you've never heard of. One's name is Lyle, and then you're disappointed with whatever you're getting.
Yeah, but they actually killed once they get to Morocco.
Yeah,
people actually love them there.
Well, once they seen that Samori and not the Simon yeah. Garfunkel.
I guess something about these kind of like American and English like expats just getting to see some Americans playing like famous pop songs was just mm-hmm. such a treat for them being in Morocco mm-hmm. that they ate it up a little more.
I also, yeah, I mean, yeah, oh, go on.
I love how their dreams also of being like these two singers are so like incongruous to all the music that's going on at the exact same time. Like they're looking at like, posters of the Talking Heads and like, why aren't we the Talking Heads?
Yeah. and they're like, you expect these types of characters to be like 20-year-old guys or something, mm-hmm. but they're like yeah. two middle-aged men who like quit their jobs to try to become songwriters. And they're trying to yes. do this like a 60s, like a singer songwriter kind of music mm-hmm. that like no one is into anymore.
Well, it's like 60s, but also like jingles. Mm-hmm. They're mm-hmm. like,
yeah.
There's no actual no attempt at recreating the 1960s or what was happening at that time. It is we yeah. are basically writing jingles about just things we see.
Yeah, and that seems like what they're really trying to do is write like commercial jingles. Like there's not like a lot of musicianship to it.
Yeah.
Love the idea of like these guys there. I mean, at the time they were like pushing 50, mm-hmm. both mm-hmm. of them.
Yeah.
Like you never get to see like, this is what J-Lo's second act should have been about. Mm-hmm. It's like somebody like quitting their life and just going for it. Like, mm-hmm. I love that. It does. It's kind of the American dream set in 1980s where I think everything was kind of hell.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. that's kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of them like quitting their jobs to do this is also yeah. so ridiculous too, especially since Dustin Hoffman was his job was a piano player. Like he like that yeah. but he quit his job yeah. doing music to like do music. And it's like, wouldn't you at least want to get paid to play some songs? Like, that was already your job.
The scene that I think made so I showed this to my girlfriend, and this was her first time seeing it too, and we both laughed so hard at the scene with Warren Beatty as the ice cream man and never stopping and just constantly singing songs and be like,
oh, in his song that he's writing is about ice cream. Like, because he's an ice cream man and he's just thinking about ice cream and writing a little love song about it.
It's so perfect. And also, he looks so silly in the ice cream man suit. Like, there's so many layers to it. Man, Beatty's great in this. I think this is my favorite Warren Beatty performance, period.
Wow.
He's too cool in everything else.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in Shampoo, he's the coolest guy that ever lived. And that sucks for me. Like, I'd much rather see this guy just be a buffoon.
Yeah. Dick Tracy sort of works for me in the same way, but because like he thinks that he's cool, but he is so not cool as Dick Tracy.
That's the perfect, like that is like, oh, you're old now, and like you're holding on to something that you liked when you were seven, and like Dick Tracy is not cool in 1990, at all.
Yeah, it's funny because I think of Warren Beatty as kind of like a goofy guy because of like Bullworth and stuff. But then like when you watch something like Bonnie and Clyde when he's young and he's supposed to be like this cool, like sexy guy, it's almost like silly to me. Like, that's not who you are. Like, I mean, I guess he was sort of like a Hollywood heartthrob in his day, but it just doesn't seem like who he really is to me.
And he was also the Will Chamberlain of Hollywood, like famously, like fucking like hundreds of women,
thousands, according
to like Sumless by Biscuit.
Yeah, Carly Simon wrote that song about maybe
until 3 years later when he met Annette Bening.
That's what it took to finally tame him, to tame the wild beast.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, she did something that no other person did to Warren Beatty, and I want to know what it is. I'll wait for him to be in the hospital, and I'll like dress up like a doctor. I'll be like, "What's that? What'd you do?" Yeah.
A through line in all of the three Elaine May movies I've seen now is that she has this way of writing men that's so good. That's like I think maybe at its best in A New Leaf, but I mean, we were talking about this with Mikey and Nikki, which is a much more serious movie. And like the way she portrays those two guys is like so honest, but like it's like sympathetic, but it doesn't shy away from showing like how fucked up they both are. Mm-hmm. And then like, and this in like a comedic context, the way these like male characters are ridiculed and the way they interact with women is like so bizarre. Like the way they both play off of Isabella Gianni, where they're like clueless, and like that first scene where Dustin Hoffman thinks she's a boy, and he just she just flashes a titty at him, and he's like, "Oh, look what you have!" Yeah. It's like it's such a funny thing. And then the whole thing with Warren Beatty like wrestling with her and like is just like grabbing her boobs and being like, "Are these?" And he just like keeps like fondling them until she finally throws him off, like just so like clueless and confused about like just dealing with a woman. It's really funny.
What are you doing? Stealing passports, breaking in, kissing men on the mouth. Yeah. That's not a way for a 15-year-old boy.
Yeah, she kisses him to distract him, and he still thinks it's like a little boy. But he's like, was clearly like, he's like having like his sexuality questioned a little bit because he clearly like enjoyed it, but he still thinks it's a 15-year-old boy, and he's like kind of confused. And then part where he says he's been like thinking about her, and he's like, "I picture you wearing girls' clothes." Like, this is such a fucking weird thing to say. Like, he still hasn't quite. Like he knows she's not a boy, but he's still kind of like thinking about her as a boy. Like it seems very like sexually confused in a way that's like that they don't put like a huge spotlight on.
I mean, yeah,
I love how his character also gets like very confusing occasional pieces of exposition, like how he's like, "Oh yeah, I used to shoot every single day before they built that tire factory."
Yeah, what is that? What do you mean, tire factory?
What are you gonna say, Sean?
Oh, I was going to agree with Trevor. Is that Elaine May? Like, she did write guys like no one else did. Like, I mean, like truly, like Heartbreak Kid. Mm-hmm. The reason why that works so well, it's just like how fucking flawed Charles Grodin is.
Yeah,
and like Mikey and Nikki is just like the most accurate portrayal of like dude friendship. Like, just like the idea that like you just want your friend to do better, but like he can't, so you just have to, I guess, kill him. I know that.
Yeah.
Like, when I was watching that, like, I was really trying to get out of a friendship with my friend. And, like, I was like, this is, like, really speaking to me. It's so dumb. Because you can't ever say how you're really feeling. Mm-hmm. And, like, Elaine May understood that. And no one else has kind of ever done anything close to that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like,
yeah, I think thinking of Mikey and Nikki, that makes me think that, like, sort of the consistent thing with how she writes men is that they're like little boys pretending to be grown-ups, mm-hmm. you know? And then that's sort of like, you know, that's like a very, like, it's a very, like, sad, like, conclusion in Mikey and Nikki, where he's like, where he starts, like, crying and like, begging for his life, like he's like in like this childish way, like, they're all little boy, like Walter Matthau in A New Leaf is like just such a little boy, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think she's completely right.
Yeah.
Like, if I was like a male friend of Elaine May and saw any of her movies, like, or if she asked for like thoughts, I would probably just apologize for my behavior.
Yeah.
I'd be like, you're trying to make me feel bad, and you did. Like Mike Nichols mm-hmm. must have apologized to her for something he's done after watching one.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why he officially like hired her at the end of his career, like when he did like Primary Colors and shiz. He was like, well, I still gotta like apologize for you for what I did in 1963.
Yeah, and probably also because she has that insight on male behavior mm-hmm. that he just needs.
She like it makes so much sense that like in her 20s and 30s she just like was in like improv with a bunch of like comedian dudes
mm-hmm. being the one woman in Compass Players, like mm-hmm. literally like everyone is like the strongest personality. You have like a psychopath in Del Close, you mm-hmm. have like Alan Arkin, who's just he's kind of crazy too, Mike yeah. Nichols super genius, and then you're somehow the smartest one of the group.
Yeah,
it had to be so difficult for her. Mm-hmm. And luckily it was all easy for her after she reached success.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I really like the Isabel Adjani character, how like, you know, it's very funny that she ultimately ends up like really liking both of the guys, but it's like the way she has to play off of them is very like, you know, they're so like childish and just like, you know, so enthralled by like this beautiful woman, but she's like, she's got like such like so much more important things to deal with that she just has to like brush it all off. You know, you don't get this like kind of snarky, like, you know, like she's not being like, oh, oh my God, man. She's just kind of like, just like ignoring all of it because she has more important stuff to worry about.
I love that because there's like an economy to all of her scenes where like these guys keep trying to extend the scene and she will just do anything to stop them from talking. So because she has so much more important stuff to do. So that's where you get her flashing them or her kissing Warren Beatty. It's just like, stop being a boy for a second. Like, it's pretty great.
It's such a weird thing, but like to skip any conversation about like convincing him that you're a woman just to like flash a titty, mm-hmm. just to like skip.
You gotta wonder, was this anyone's first titty in a movie? Was seeing like Ishtar in 1987?
It must have been because this was a PG-13 movie. Because mm-hmm. Back then, I guess you could show a titty in a PG-13 movie. If more preteens had known about this movie and known that they could see a titty in it mm-hmm. without parental supervision, like this might have done big numbers at the box office. They should have gotten the word out.
that should have absolutely been in like a commercial or on the poster. Yeah. One titty, like because like no preteens were like, you know what, I gotta go see this Warren Beatty Dustin Hoffman comedy.
Yeah, like they needed to get some word of mouth around like middle schools. Yeah. Like, like you gotta see this Star movie. Trust me.
Yeah, it should have been marketed like American Pie. Like somebody someone should have accidentally drank Kona in the movie too.
I do wonder what the marketing was like for this. I'm sure it was a very like inadequate and misguided marketing effort. Like they probably didn't know what to do with this movie.
Well, didn't it get eviscerated like in while it was filming, like how much it was like going over budget and how like Paramount?
Columbia.
We're not giving Elaine final cut and stuff like that. Mm. Like it was all in the trades. Like they destroyed
sabotaging
her.
Their own movie.
Mm. Yeah, almost to like prove a point because like Elaine wouldn't stop editing.
Yeah. She just loved to like just do so many cuts. Like I think like if I remember correctly for A New Leaf, I think she like edited for like a straight year.
Yeah.
Wow.
They removed like the entire like an entire other like storyline from that movie. Like
oh yeah.
Where they actually kill a guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh really?
Yeah, it was like the guy that was like the like financier who was obsessed with Elaine May. Yeah, Mafia like had him killed. That was like gonna be it's gonna be a 3-hour movie and like have like that whole plot, but it vanished. Wow. And famously on Mikey and Nikki as well, she like because she had such a hard time in general, she like if I remember correctly, I think she shot over like 1 million feet of film, and then she just like. She knew that she was going to lose the final cut, I think, Paramount. And so she stole 2 of the reels of the movie, 2 of the important reels, and left them in her husband's friend's like garage in Connecticut, I think, and wouldn't budge on it until she finally got a cut that she like partially approved of, which eventually edited for the Criterion later. She changed it up.
Mikey and Nikki is so like Sean, like what you were saying about Warren Beatty in this movie. It almost feels like she's like showing up Cassavetes a little bit with Mikey and Nikki to cast him as one of the leads in this movie. That's like her doing like kind of a Cassavetes style movie and almost maybe doing it better than Cassavetes. Like, like I think that's like a really dope move to do that.
I mean, I do think she was like kind of a, or I mean, she's still alive and she's supposed to be making that movie with Dakota Johnson. We'll see if that comes out. But like, she kind of was a like limitless talent, like in a, there was no, like, I would just listen to her on Phil Rosenthal's podcast. I don't listen to Phil Rosenthal's podcast, but she was on it and it was like, Elaine May on a podcast, I need to listen to this. And it's really interesting. She definitely, did you guys listen?
I haven't. No. I'll have to check it out. I didn't know Phil Rosenthal had a podcast.
I'm not surprised to hear he has one.
It is 100% food related, believe it or not. But the entire
really, that's a new avenue for him.
Doesn't he have like a Netflix show about him eating?
Yeah.
Somebody feed Phil. But he gets Elaine a pastrami sandwich, and the entire time he's asking her questions that she doesn't want to answer, she just keeps taking larger and larger bites and answering with her mouthful. And it is very fun.
That's so good.
But it also in it, like she like kind of goes into like, cause they're talking to her about like her improv background and stuff. And they're like, well, who are your influences? And she goes, we invented it. Like we didn't have any influences. It was like, I guess like what we were reading at the time or like, or things we saw in film, but like we invented it. Like, no one inspired
it's
us?
It's just pure creativity, not, like, trying to be, like, the new version of someone else.
Yeah,
and I think, like, with Mikey and Nikki, it was almost like, I think she was kind of doing, like, a takedown of all the people that she grew up around in Philadelphia, including, like, her dad. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that also makes it feel grittier and also maybe more of a... it's why the characters kind of can be unsympathetic because maybe she doesn't have like rose colored glasses while viewing them.
No, for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do love in Mikey and Nikki how there's definitely like, you can tell she definitely has like this anger towards Philadelphia. Like she definitely like kind of hates the city a lot.
Yeah. It is, you're 100% right. But we could tell in Ishtar, New York looks great in it. And you know it's a great New York because Carol Kane's in it for a little bit.
The beautiful Carol Kane.
The true sign that a movie was made in New York from 1971 to 1993 is Carol Kane has an appearance.
Yep.
Before Parker Posey replaced her as a New York landmark.
Every year they have the election. Who's the new ingenue of New York City?
It's like, oh, wow, this year it was Bobby Cannavale.
I do like the little how like there's like this little like mini New York movie at the beginning before like the plot goes into effect. Like it was funny because you get that scene of the archaeologists in Ishtar kind of like setting up the like stakes of the movie and stuff, but that only comes in after you've had this whole little mini movie about the guy's relationship in New York. Yeah. And I love the ledge scene. It's like it feels very like kind of Woody Allen, like with Dustin Hoffman on the ledge and his parents are there like trying to talk and then the rabbi shows up and he's like, oh great, the rabbi's here.
Yeah.
And they're just like talking like very like kindly, like, oh, we get blue sometimes too, you know. Like not like they're not even barely taking it seriously.
Yeah, I feel like the implication is this has happened many times with him. Like this is his move. Which I think
they know he's not gonna do it.
He's not gonna do it. It's why like when he's always pouting in the New York a section of this movie, and I really like that about him. And yes, like Drive My Car, that is not the real movie. You have been misled, and the opening credits should start 30 minutes into it.
Yeah. I feel like it's very fascinating too how like I feel like the like reaction to the movie over the years has like shifted, where like for years everyone's like, oh, it's awful, and it's like a joke. It was even a joke in the Save the Cat book, and then it went to like
Save the Cat.
And then from there, who else could write a movie as good as Stop or My Mom Will Shoot?
Stop or My Mom Will Shoot or Blank Check, and the best movie ever made was Legally Blonde because you knew what it was from the title.
Yeah.
What is Save the Cat? Like, what is the theory? Like, what does Save the Cat mean?
The Save the Cat is basically, like, make the characters likable enough that you will follow the movie with them, essentially.
Yeah, it's a way to make your protagonist instantly likable, is to have him, like, put milk in front of a cat on the alleyway, right. Or, like, save someone from getting hit by a car.
Instantly, I thought it was something now like that.
Yeah, you can now root for this guy.
Because
all movies are about rooting for a guy.
Yeah, I took a screenwriting class once, and a teacher said a similar thing, but he called it pet the dog. And this was like a much more subtle thing. Like if there's an opportunity for whatever's going on, if like a dog passes by the guy and he just like gives it a pat, it's just like this subtle little thing that like just made... You know, it's not even necessarily showing him making the protagonist a good person. It's just like makes them like a little bit likable
because
they stop to pet the dog.
Pet the dog is, you know, I think that is I guess a better name for it, because like I like dogs more than cats.
Yeah,
that's why it appeals to me.
Yeah, well, I don't want to ignite any dog. Cat people, dog people war, but I also like dogs more than cats. I'll pet a dog, but saving a cat, I don't know. I got things to do.
Yeah, I mean, like, listen. In Cats versus Dogs, you're supposed to root for the dog.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. And no one saves a cat in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
No, quite the opposite. The cat has to be defeated. Defeat the cat.
Yeah.
Who's the writer of the Save the Cat
book? Blake something.
Okay. It's not McKee. McKee's the other guy.
Yeah, that's the other guy.
They make fun of an adaptation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, but so I was going to say, so yeah, I went from that where it's a joke and like Save the Cat to then for like, I feel like from like 2000 to like 2016, 2017, the popular conception was basically, you know, the first 30 minutes were good, but then after that, it goes into the toilet. And now we can just be like, no, that's good too. It's fun to see Charles Grodin play like this, like CIA guy that constantly gets in obstacles and whatnot.
The most accurate portrayal of what the CIA actually does, like film history, it's amazing. And I could understand that, like, perhaps a Reagan White House overstepped their boundaries and tried to silence this movie in some way by leaking. Because, like, I mean, at that time, I mean, I'm not going to go into conspiracy theories, but I'm pretty sure that the CIA...
No, like, please do.
Yeah, I mean, like, I mean, I've read enough things on Reddit to convince myself that perhaps the CIA and Hollywood actually do have some sort of symbiotic relationship.
Oh, well, that's not even really conspiracy theory territory. That's sort of, in some ways, substantiated. Like, maybe not, like, the full extent of their relationship, but it's, like, it's definitely known that the CIA has had influence on certain movies, you know.
The
Argo thing being the most famous kind of example of them working together.
Or
but...
every movie Catherine Bigelow has made since like the year 2005.
Sure. but that's like a little more in unconfirmed territory, right? Like, don't people kind of assume that the CIA was involved in like whatever it was called? The Bin Laden movie, or is that like a known fact?
I feel like there was a report that like at least it got money from like the U.S. military.
Well, the Pentagon thing they do with like almost any movie that features like a military, you know, hardware, tanks and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, they'll like basically just lend actual military equipment to the movie as long as they approve of the script, and they'll ask them to like change things. Like, I think even like Avatar, originally they ended up being called like something, like it's like a sort of like a private like military force. Originally it was just supposed to be like the US military had like the military presence on Pandora, and they changed it just slightly to be like a private defense contractor thing, but they were still, you know, still sort of clearly an arm of the US government, but they just had to not directly say that it was like the US Marines.
Now, do you think the US government was involved in like in the army now with Pauly Shore? Like, do you think they had like a hand in that?
Maybe.
Like,
I mean, if it had tanks and like an artillery and stuff,
rocket launchers. Oh my god, it was so funny. He never pointed it the right way.
it would be really funny if like it turned out in like 20 or 30 years of internet, Andy Dick was actually a CIA op.
I can definitely see Andy Dick getting like getting some kind of like Ted Kaczynski MK Ultra stuff, like they tested weird stuff on him.
But so Ishtar.
Yeah, sorry, I'm getting like some lag from Sean's end. I don't know if that's just me or.
Yeah, I got a message saying that it was my internet was unstable.
Okay,
I'm like, tell me about it.
Well,
but like,
you're still coming through.
Am I better now?
Oh yeah, you're better right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But. Yeah, Valerie, you were saying Ishtar, something about Ishtar.
Ishtar. I actually didn't have anything. I was just like kind of saying it to like, if we. Oh, actually, Filled here's something, silence. Sean. I did listen to a few episodes of Your Two Dads. I thought it was a good show.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that ended because Comedy Central seems like it ended, and we ended with it. We went down with the ship. But it was fun. Thank you for listening.
What is that? Could you tell the listeners maybe what that is in case someone doesn't know what you're talking about?
I used to have a podcast called Your Two Dads with my co-host Julian McCullough, and we, you know, we were not the first dad cast, but the only dad cast, and we tried to interview only parents, and then Comedy Central was like, you need to get more famous people. We did one episode with Corinne Olympias from The Bachelor.
Oh, and, wow. And so this was like a Comedy Central produced thing?
Yeah. And so we did, like, I think, like, 50 or so episodes. And then now it's over. I don't talk to Julian anymore. We don't talk to our kids anymore.
Oh.
Like...
But it was
yeah.
fun while it lasted. And that, and also fun while it lasted was the film Ishtar.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which after 107 minutes, just it was like we've had our fun. We're gonna go our different ways now.
Yeah.
I do love how it did seem like from everything I read from it, it seemed like basically that the person that everyone was most angry at, whether it was that Putterman guy that like was the new head of Columbia, like when they were wrapping shooting, who was also angry at Hoffman, but mostly Beatty. And then like, just like Beatty had for years made fun of Siskel and Ebert and a bunch of other critics. So they were all like, your movie's having trouble. We're gonna destroy it. And basically like, it seemed like Elaine May wasn't even really thought of and was just kind of like, she'll just be like a, like an associate killing that will just like take out also and put into director jail, which she still unfortunately is in.
It really bums me out to hear that Beatty was like shit talking her afterwards, because like, you know, I like Warren Beatty and I love Elaine May. It would have been nice. Mm-hmm. Like, if, you know, especially being like practically blackballed by Hollywood to like get some support from her more famous male collaborators.
It really sucks. I do think Elaine May is probably the person who most does not deserve director jail. Like, I would say, like, of all the people who have been in, I mean, like, like her, and then like I think Carrie and Deb, who did Can't Hardly Wait and Josie and the Pussycats, don't belong in director's jail.
Oh wow.
But they are, and that's unfair to them because I think both of those movies are great. And then Martin Brest is in director's jail.
That dude
made like Midnight Run. Like, Geely sucked, but did it suck so much that you don't want the chance of another like Midnight Run?
Or another Beverly Hills Cop.
Like, I mean, like, no matter how bad Geely is, like, it is responsible for Ben and J-Lo getting together. So, like, you know, what an important cultural product that is, that it created 100%. Jennifer. Like, who cares about the movie?
Mm-hmm.
The couple that taught us all how to love. Like... And they're still teaching us to this day.
Yes.
Such an incredible story that they got back together after all those years and having separate marriages and stuff. Like, it's that's just so inspiring. It gives you hope.
Yeah, love always wins. Yes. That's what I'm always saying.
Sometimes.
When I'm accepting,
I would say sometimes it does.
Love always wins, guys.
Love
always wins. All right, sure. Well, so here's kind of a fun a thing to think about, maybe, since this is the Odd Pod. I guess I just thought of it. We were kind of talking about earlier how Hoffman and Beatty are like a great comedy duo. But I can't help but wonder if this movie was made like 10, 20 years earlier and was starring Jack Lemmon and Walter Matthau. Because we know Jack Lemmon is a decent musician. We've seen him play the piano, the bongos, the cello, I think, and Some Like It Hot. I feel like Matthau maybe in the Dustin Hoffman role and Jack Lemmon in the Warren Beatty role. It's just fun for me to imagine that kind of thing because those two are so great together. Obviously, we love them.
That would have been perfect.
The Odd Pod.
I mean, They're the tops. I love Lemon and Matthau.
Yeah.
Although I do think if you showed Lemon a titty, he would pass out.
I mean, in Some Like It Hot, Lemon plays such a good, like, skeevy, like, horny guy. You know, I feel like he.
He does, but it's like it's 50s horny. That's different.
Yeah, yeah.
Like Hoffman, like he's seen a pair of breasts in his life, but like Jack Lemmon, I feel like after the 70s, he only played like, you know, characters who are like so prudish that I would have loved to see just like, you know, some hardcore nudity around yeah. him.
Well, just I mean, in like, Grumpy Old Men, we
smoke
get a...
comes out of his like neck thing. What mm-hmm. is this called?
Oh, in Grumpy Old Men, we get a very horny Jack Lemmon, and that's another movie where it's two guys competing for the love of a woman, and. Mm-hmm. And there's even, we talked about yeah. this on the podcast, but there's even a scene in Grumpy Old Men where they make it very clear to the audience that Jack Lemmon did raw dog. Why am I forgetting her name right now? The lady in the movie. Anne Margaret?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that weird 90s run that they did where mm-hmm. Grumpy Old Men out to see Grumpier Old Men and... Not so much the Odd Couple Part 2. That one's really hard to watch.
that's a rough one.
But Out to Sea is really fun and weird and like just like they're very horny in that one too. America really wanted to see Lemon and Matthau be horny in the 90s. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, they
spawned the horny old man movie genre.
Yeah. There wouldn't be a dirty grandpa without a grumpy old man.
Yeah. They were the original.
The original dirty grandpas, yeah.
They should live, die, repeat that and just change the title of Grumpy Old Men to Dirty Grandpas.
Yeah, I think we need to bring back old man horny buddy comedies, because the problem with Dirty Grandpa is it's just De Niro.
Yeah,
you don't have the dynamic of the two dirty grandpas competing with each other. You know, if we got a current day Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty, if they did like a Dirty Grandpa, that could be fun.
That's fun, and also probably closer to their real life selves.
Yeah.
They're probably dirty grandpas. I mean, D-Hop's got soft canceled.
Oh, yeah. I was going to ask, is he canceled? Like, was his thing, like, I can't remember if it was just a thing where he was, like, an asshole, or if it was, like, he actually did some dirty stuff.
I think he sexually harassed women on the sets in the 80s, and... And then when they like said the story, it was like the weirdest thing ever. Like he was like how he takes his eggs was like ovulating or something.
Oh god! Like, oh no! Really weird. Oh man! Old guys are so weird.
It's like that can't even be sexy to you when you're mm-hmm. saying that. That's
yeah.
Yeah, that's not even a word that like even sounds relatively sexy.
Yeah.
You
can't make ovulating like a horny word.
It's that Andrew Cuomo style harassment where like mm-hmm. you just don't even know how to talk to a woman.
Well, in that way he is sort of like his Ishtar character.
Yeah, I guess so.
But you could see Warren Beatty like close to like 90 or 95 or however old he is, like playing like a dirty grandpa, like did I ever see that like video that he did with Leonard Maltin to like maintain the Dick Tracy rights?
No.
So he made this video, and I think it was like in like the TCM set. That's basically just him being interviewed in character as Dick Tracy, being like, and he was just like asking him questions about like his creation in like the early 20th century, and being like, "So what do you think of that movie by Warren Beatty?" And he's like, "Huh, that Warren Beatty." Typical limousine liberal.
So why is it that he needs to hold on to the Dick Tracy movie rights? Is he planning on making a sequel?
I guess that's like his dream. Like
seems like a little song late now. Maybe maybe let someone else take a crack at it. You know, you're.
Oh, he's just gonna see the new Indiana Jones get the worst ideas. Like, oh, us elderly can do things. I'm just like, who wants to see a 90-year-old Dick Tracy? Like, people already didn't want to see, like, a 58-year-old Dick Tracy. maybe he wants to be paid for the rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, if like, he would just get, like, a producer credit if they made, like, a reboot or something, and he would get money mm-hmm. off of it. I mean, that would make sense, you know?
Yeah.
He's also bizarre.
I was assuming it was like an artistic thing, but it might just be like a business move.
Mm-hmm. Didn't he spend like 25 years trying to make that Howard Hughes movie that like no one cared about when it came out?
Mm-hmm. That was like his passion project.
Why is anyone's passion to play like the weirdest guy to ever live?
Yeah.
Especially after you see The Aviator, it's like, it's done. Mm-hmm. Like, you don't.
Yeah, but we only really got the early Howard Hughes years in that. You know, they give you a little taste of later on losing his mind Howard Hughes, but you don't get to see all the years of him being like a weird shut-in, mm-hmm. wearing tissue boxes for shoes and stuff.
I love just learning about whoever's passion project. It is, and like 95% of the time, the passion project is like a pure like turd. There's no, it's like, why are you?
Yeah. I guess that's what makes it a passion, is everyone just keeps saying no to it. Mm-hmm. And you're like, well, they can't reject this. I want to do this movie about old Howard Hughes ruining a young girl's life.
Well, Red still rules. Got to give him credit for that. Maybe he's an asshole for being mean to Elaine May. You know, I generally assume that like any guys in Hollywood are probably assholes behind mm-hmm. the scenes, even if there's no stories about it. Mm-hmm. It's safer that way to just assume. But man, Red's is so fucking good.
Splendor in the Grass is probably the closest to his character in Ishtar. Mm. Is he's kind of like a dumb hick. And he's just ruining Natalie Wood's life because the movie is just all about how teenage girls' emotions are just too much. Thanks, Elia Kazan.
Yeah. Fucking Kazan. I remember once
good
like
dude.
I remember like one time I was gonna like in the class I had to watch On the Waterfront, and I remember like within like 2 minutes I realized like, oh, this is about like the HUAC trials, and so like I didn't have that like contemporary thing of just being like, oh, was he like, well, On the Waterfront is great, but what, how can this man be so bad, when I was just like, no, he sucks, that movie's about like union busting, fuck him.
yeah he made that on top of what he was doing, mm-hmm. like just a bad guy.
In high school, I took this philosophy class, which was kind of just like a blow off class. It was like an older like English teacher, and I guess he just made the curriculum and just kind of talked about whatever he wanted, and he would just show us movies in the class and just say it has something to do with philosophy, and we watched On the Waterfront, and he called it like an existentialist film. And like, which like, I don't know, it's not really, I guess, but that's where I saw it, and I'm trying to watch it thinking like, oh, I'm learning about existentialism watching this. It was, he showed us some good movies though. We watched Cool Hand Luke, you know, that was cool, but it was basically just him, just an excuse to like show movies and be like, oh yeah, this movie is about Kant or whatever.
Nice.
Cool Hand Luke's super cool, and that is what Dustin Hoffman should have said when he's like, how do I take my eggs, like Cool Hand Luke, because doesn't he eat a lot of eggs in that?
Yeah, I need, oh, yeah, yeah. He eats 50 eggs.
Yeah, he eats 50 eggs. That's how I take my eggs in 50s, rather than like just grossly say ovulating it'd be fun. He would have to explain it a bunch. It's not a better joke.
Yeah, it's also like, it's confusing what the sexual implication of it is. It's like, is he saying he wants to get her pregnant? Because if ovulating.
Is he a Ken Bone style guy?
How do I like my eggs? Inside of a woman's uterus. That's how I like them. Okay, that's cool, Dustin. Well, is there anything else to cover? Did you make any kind of a trivia game segment for this one, Valerie? Sorry to put you on the spot like that. I know you did that once, and it seems like something you like doing.
Oh, yeah. One time before, we talked about the movie The Couch Trip with Dan Aykroyd and Map Owl, and I made this game where we went through the IMDb of the movie, and like I said, like, is this piece of trivia real or fake for the IMDb page?
It was the most confusing game of all time, because first of all, it was all the most inane, like, this stuff wasn't trivia. It was just kind of like, this movie features this actor who is also in another movie, like it, but also she said it was a real or fake, but it wasn't, because the thing was just whether it was actually on IMDb or not. So like, she could say a thing. So the fake ones weren't actually fake. It was just her saying another inane fact about the movie. And we just had to figure out whether or not that was on IMDb or just something she noticed. Great game.
I love that. I have no doubt The Couch Trip had great trivia.
Well, let's go through some of the Couch Trip trivia.
Why are we doing Couch Trip trivia? That's not... The listeners have heard this. We did a whole episode on it.
Well, shouldn't
we be doing Ishtar trivia? You're really doing this.
I'll just give one as like an example. This is an example of a piece of trivia that was on the IMDb page. One of two psychiatric comedy flops of the late 1980s. The other was Beyond Therapy by Robert Altman.
That's not trivia. That's just that's not what trivia is.
Yeah, you couldn't put that in Trivial Pursuit. Like.
What was the other psychiatric comedy flop? What the fuck? What are you talking about?
What's going on in the late 80s?
Well,
that was literally someone who just looked at like the Beyond Therapy like box office and the Couch Trip box office and was like, huh, they both failed.
It's someone who has a similar kind of brain to Valerie, except they're also weird enough to feel the need to put their observations on IMDb for some reason.
Okay. Quick game of real or fake.
Wait, when you say real or fake, what you mean is on IMDb trivia or not on IMDb trivia?
Yes.
Okay.
A group of vultures is called a committee.
What?
A group of vultures is called a committee.
So is this
fake?
I'm going to say real, because why else would you have brought it up just now if you hadn't just read it on your phone?
Real. This was on the Ishtar IMDb.
Yeah, okay. I thought so.
I mean, that is kind of trivia. I mean, there are vultures.
Yeah, but it's not really trivia about the movie. It's like there's vultures in the movie, and I also feel like those names of groups of animals things are just like made up, like randomly, like whoever. I don't know if those are like scientific terms. Like, it seems like maybe like the panda one is like a pandemonium of pandas. Like, that doesn't make any sense. Someone just thought that was funny and they put it in the
movie. That has to be fake. I'm gonna guess fake on everything, by the way, even if it's not trivia.
No, but that's real. That's a real thing that they say.
I'm not going to accept.
Okay.
This. Fauci lied. People lied.
Obviously, with crows, it's a murder of crows. And that's just because crows are spooky, so they call it a murder. Like, someone in the 19th century just made that up and it went in the dictionary, you know?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, everything's kind
that's
of true.
True. I sensed it as I started to say that. I was thinking, like, everything's made up. What are you talking about? But
living in the house, and the house is property, and that property doesn't exist because it's all capitalist like nonsense.
Yeah. I shouldn't have fucking said anything.
More trivia. More trivia. Okay.
We can do. We can.
I love trivia.
All right. Well, let's do it.
So
far, it's 1-0 me, right?
Yeah.
Was the fourth film in history to cost more than $50 million after Superman, Superman 2, and The Cotton Club.
Okay, it's obviously real because I can see you reading it.
Yeah, that was real. I did see you.
Oh, I forgot the other trick that I figured out, like, to tell whether it was something she thought of or whether it was on the thing, is that she didn't write the facts down beforehand. So when she was saying one that was fake, there would be like stumbles, like, but when it's a real one, she would just say it perfectly because she's reading it off the website.
I won't confirm or deny that, Trevor.
Well, that was real, right? We both got real on that one.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
That's 2 points for me.
Elaine May shot over 50 takes of the scene when there were vultures.
Okay, that's a tricky one.
All right.
The scene when there are vultures.
Animals are notorious. Animals are notoriously hard to work with. I'm going to say it's real.
Okay.
I'm going to say real also.
Okay, it's real, but it's on the IMDb trivia.
Damn it! Oh, you got me. See, I was on the fence about that because the scene where there are vultures could either be something from Valerie's brain, but it could just as easily be some idiot on IMDb. All right. Oh, well, now we're all tied up. Now we're 2-2. Oh, wait, no. I can't remember. Oh, no, you said...
Both,
oh, never mind.
Yeah, you both
we both got that one wrong. Mm-hmm. See, I said the game should be called IMDb or VMDb. VMDb standing for Valerie's Movie Database. Because then the question is this fact on IMDb or is it in Valerie's brain?
Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty, both recent Oscar winners, were each paid $5 million, a sum that was considered impressive at the time, and in 2009, is still a considerable paycheck.
I mean...
See, now I think she could be tricking us by finding somewhere else that she's reading this off of, because she's still clearly reading it.
Yeah. I think it's real, And honestly, in 2009, $5 million was nothing to sneeze at.
I'm going to say fake.
Sean is correct. That was on IMDb.
Damn it.
All right, we're tied. We're tied.
We're all tied up. Okay, give us one last tiebreaker.
Yes. Okay. Despite the film's reputation as one of the biggest box office failures of all time, it was number one at the box office in its first week of release. Next week, with the release of Beverly Hills Cop 2, the film quickly dropped to fourth place.
I think it's fake.
I'll say real, just so we can have a point to settle this.
Trevor has one. That is real.
Oh!
All right. Sean?
That was, what a wild ride that was. I truly love it.
Sean, thanks so much for coming on the show. It was great to have you.
Thank you for having me. Val, you absolutely need to be a game show host,
yes,
I think.
Yes, definitely.
You asking questions and then waiting has like warmed my heart. It is so funny.
Oh, thank you.
So what are you working on, Sean? What's going on with you? You want to plug anything?
Yeah, watch Solar Opposites on Hulu, and then I also have a podcast with my friend Nick Maritato coming out either in December or the new year called My Stupid Sweet 16, where it's really just a dumb tournament style show where we rate things like best human experiences and stuff.
Nice.
That's cool.
You guys should both come on, please.
Yeah, absolutely. That sounds fun. I really like Solar Opposites, by the way. That's cool. You right on that show.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's fun. Mm-hmm. Oh, man. I had a great time. This is the best.
I'm now going
to listen to the whole back catalog.
Okay, yeah. Cool. And We have a lot of our back catalog is presently on like a Patreon. It's a long story, but I'll send you like the links.
Yeah, we could send you the episodes if you really want to hear them.
I want to hear it. This was so fun.
Well, there's four on the public feed now, but then there's a bunch of older ones that are on the Patreon. It's hard to explain, but yeah, sure.
Fine, I get it. You want me to sign up for the Patreon?
No, I don't want you. I don't want you to sign up for the Patreon. Yeah. We're just really bad at releasing podcasts.
Yeah,
we're gonna put more of the old ones on the main feed eventually. We just haven't gotten to it.
We basically have like found new ways to make no money doing podcasts.
Yeah, yeah. How can we make sure no more than 12 people ever hear this?
It's so funny. Recently, I was on this one podcast called Mike on Us, which is like a political film podcast, and the co-host Will was on the show, and it's one of my favorite episodes we ever did, because we like went through the filmography of Harvey Miller, who wrote Private Benjamin and Get Away with Murder, his whole IMDb page where everyone called him like the Harv was a friend to everyone in Hollywood. and at the end of the episode, Will was like, listen to that episode, that was a lot of fun. Never released back to the main feed.
Oh shit, we should have put that one up. No, well, what I did when that came out is I put up the link to the other one, because there's the other Will Sloan episode that is on the main feed.
Yeah.
And then I was kind of like, oh, and also there's whatever. Who cares about this? Thanks for listening, everybody. Thanks, Sean. This has been Elaine Mania. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.
Bye.
Telling the truth can be dangerous business. Honest and popular don't go hand in hand. If you admit that you can play the accordion, no one will hire you in a rock and roll band.